we're going to start. We have three bills before us today. And each of these bills will be bills that the motion will be to have them considered and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus committee bill. So the first bill we have before us is Representative Erin Murphy's bill, the first one of hers, on heart disease. Welcome to the committee, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and happy Valentine's Day.
Thank you. You too.
Would someone like to move the bill?
We have motion to...
Madam Chair, I would like to submit House File 678 for consideration and for laying.
For laying over the possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. As I said, I am Representative Erin Murphy, and I'm here today to talk with you about legislation that, if enacted, will help prevent heart attacks and strokes. By way of introduction, I want to let you know that I am a registered nurse and spent some time in the operating room and have seen the heart firsthand, and it is indeed a mighty muscle. And it's also the metaphoric home of feelings. My heart is broken. My heart is filled with joy and love. And I think on this day, Valentine's Day, I think it's appropriate to talk about the metaphoric place of feelings and the heart, and also to talk about legislation that can protect the heart. I hope after the proper scrutiny of this legislation that you choose to support the bill. It calls for funding for the Heart Disease and Stroke Prevention Unit in the Department of Health. The goal of this effort is the prevention of heart disease and stroke. I have with me today Dr. Russell Fusker, a cardiologist, and he is here to share with you his expertise and his perspective.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Representative Murphy, and thank you for allowing me to testify here today. As you heard, my name is Russell Lupker, and I'm a cardiologist at the University of Minnesota. I have also been a volunteer for the American Heart Association for almost 30 years, and that's the origin of my testimony today, that Heart Association connection. I should also say I've been a member of the Minnesota Heart Disease and Stroke Prevention Steering Committee for 6 years, and I'll tell you a bit about that story in a moment. I need to remind you, if you aren't reminded regularly from your own experiences, that heart disease and stroke are a leading killer of Minnesotans, despite the progress that we've made in recent years. And of the people that die of these diseases, two-thirds of them die out of hospital. They have no chance to have the opportunity to the very advanced methods we have for our patients. And of those two-thirds of Minnesotans who die, half of them have no idea they have any disease. Their first inkling is their last inkling, because they don't survive. And many of us would say that prevention is the only effective strategy for dealing with that problem. The Heart Disease and Stroke Prevention Unit at MDH at the Minnesota Department of Health collects, interprets, and reports data on cardiovascular disease in the state. It has developed a plan, a prevention plan for the state, with a committee that I'm a member of, a steering committee of physicians, of researchers, of public health experts, and a variety of organizations, including the Heart Association, including insurance people like Health Partners, the University, the Mayo Clinic, and a number of others. This effort, the unit has been supported by the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta since 2000 with a planning grant. It has been a modest grant in terms of funds. It has supported four people. And we have been waiting, planning and waiting for the next step, which is called basic implementation. This year we were again told there will be no implementation grants, and there may not even be any more planning grants. So perhaps there will be no funding this year for this program. Other states, many of whom have not gotten planning grants like we have invested in units. Michigan is one example, using state funds, and have already developed effective programs. Others have received implementation money from the CDC. So what you have before you is the result of years of meetings with volunteers like me, with the staff, and we have a plan, an action plan that we've put forward, focusing on working with businesses, with schools, with disadvantaged groups, with professional groups, with hospitals. We look at risk factor modification, including methods such as screening, public awareness campaigns, professional education, web-based approaches. And the unit has and would continue to monitor these effects. We've been planning for 6 years, waiting for implementation. Other states have moved on with the CDC and their own funds. And while Minnesotans, and we're very proud of this, are healthier than other people, there's still much to do. The plans of this unit to confront the epidemic of cardiovascular disease through prevention, I think, are sound ones. So we're asking you for support at the level of $400,000 to both support this unit, if indeed the CDC and their budget cuts eliminates this program, but I think more importantly, push it forward into the implementation phase. I should say in finale, I'm here representing the Heart Association. The Heart Association does not accept government funds and so would not benefit directly from a program like this. But the Heart Association is committed to reducing heart attack and stroke in this state and is very committed along those lines. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions from committee members? I actually have a couple, and I'll suggest. I'm very interested in two things. One is the actual funding that you're asking for and what you were telling us about the CDC possibly eliminating funding at the federal level, it sounds like. And so what we're talking about here then is trying to have the state step in to pick up the ball here in terms of federal cuts? Or are there also state cuts? And I'm not sure what the governor did with his budget recommendations here. Can you tell us, it sounds like you asked for funding, you can give us some information on that.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can answer all of those questions. I think, you know, the part of this, of course, is the federal government's potential cuts. We don't know what those are. The other part is, even if we continue to get this planning grant from the CDC, and I would hope we would, that we would be able to actually begin implementing some of these things. We had hoped to get the 1.2 million basic implementation plan that the feds have given some states, but that's off the table. We have a number of things we need to get going, and the $400,000 we're asking for is not the whole 1.2 million, but indeed, particularly if we get the federal grant, the CDC grant renewed, would allow us to begin implementing the plan we put forward. It's my understanding that the health department does put a modest amount of money into this program. I don't know exactly what it is. I apologize for that. But indeed, it's much less than the federal component, and the federal component is very modest. It's a planning grant.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if there is someone here from the health department who could answer that question. For us, we're trying to find it in the governor's budget here. Anybody from the health department who can help us with this? Nobody here from the health department today?
Good morning. Jay McLaren with the Department of Health. Could you repeat the question, please, Madam Chair?
Yeah, we're trying to determine what commitment the Minnesota Department of Health now makes to this program, and in light of possible elimination of federal funding, is the health department recommending, did you seek more funding, or where are we at with the health department's commitment to this issue?
Madam Chair, I apologize that you're getting the B team this morning, our expert head, to step out of the committee hearing yet this morning. So I'll try to answer it as best as I can.
Okay.
Right now, we do receive funding from the federal government to do some of the activities that were laid out this morning, and in terms of applying for the implementation grant from the CDC, just from the thimble full of knowledge that I have on this program, if we apply for implementation grant and do not receive that, then we cannot receive the planning grant that we have right now. So that's the risk that we take if we go beyond just the planning grant that we have and apply for implementation from the CDC.
All right. Let me see if I understand that. In order for you to be able to have a program at all, are we talking about? I mean, is there a base budget figure that is in place now operating for this program? Or are we totally dependent on the federal CDC planning grant that we've been receiving in the past?
Madam Chair, we receive, to my knowledge, funding from the CDC for this program.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. And if you can maybe flesh that out for us a little bit more as we go forward, that would be great. Representative Murphy, I want to thank you for bringing this bill to us. I guess I'm a little surprised that we don't have an ongoing program that the state itself funds, and so we should look into this. One of my other questions is, Dr. Lupker?
Right.
You mentioned in terms of implementation that you've been working with a number of groups, and, you know, of course, one of the areas in the health department that I think probably addresses this issue or should be addressing this issue is the whole issue of health disparities or the disproportionate impact on certain groups of people. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about if we're able to appropriate some dollars here, how you might work with either in a new way or a continuing way with that that concern. And maybe you could just review for the committee here who may not all be familiar with the disparities in terms of heart disease in our community.
Madam Chairman, I thank you. I actually have published in this area, and even in Minnesota, where we view ourselves as all equal, there's a dramatic disparity between those in the lowest socioeconomic classes and those who are the wealthiest in heart disease, and it's inverse. That is, the poorest people have the most disease, and for many of these diseases, it is the worst in ethnically disadvantaged groups. And even today, as we look at large numbers of East African immigrants, we see diabetes developing in these groups as they become, a nice way to put it, better nourished than they were in Somalia or Ethiopia. And we're anticipating greater disease in those groups. This particular program, because one of the five major areas we've looked at, is indeed, has looked at health disparities. And we have a number of plans that we've put forward to try to both be more effective with these groups in basic risk factor prevention. Hypertension, for example, as we know, is twice as prevalent among African Americans as it is among Anglo Americans. I mentioned diabetes in East African populations, and frequently these things are undetected and untreated. And part of when I mentioned screening, part of our thinking is we need to work to engage these populations better and get them to good treatment before they have a heart attack and stroke. So the committee has a subcommittee in this. It has put forward a plan that I can share the details if you would like. But yes, it's an issue, and yes, we are thinking about it.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just going back to when Mr. McLaren was up there, let me get, if I understand, you get some funding from the federal government that has been kind of been used to put this plan in place, create this plan. You've applied for an implementation grant?
We have in the past applied and not received an implementation grant. And generally the word has been, well, they asked for applications, but there's no money this year. This year, and I apologize to the gentleman from the health department, this year they have apparently said, there is no money, so you don't need to bother to apply for implementation phase. So we've been working towards this. We've put forward a plan, and now we're told don't bother to apply this year for implementation because there's no funding.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
I thought I heard Mr. McLaren say was that if you applied for the implementation grant and you didn't get it, then you lost your other funding too.
I think that's probably an error, as I understand it. I think they're telling us don't bother to apply for implementation. There's no money this year, but they have not said don't bother to yet don't bother to apply for another planning year.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Dr. Loughlin, just for clarification on that, they discourage you from applying, they being the CDC at the federal level. Okay. So if I'm understanding, if the planning money may also be discontinued, and so if the committee gives no appropriations to this particular bill, there may be no ongoing heart disease and stroke prevention coming at the Minnesota Department of Health. Is that
I think that's a very possible outcome. And you may have seen in the president's budget last year, while he raised the NIH budget, asked for more, raised the National Science Foundation budget, he cut $500 million from the CDC budget. And I'm sure the CDC hopes to reverse some of that, but it's not a good starting point for programs like this.
Thank you. Thanks,
Madam Chair. But my understanding of the street knowledge of CDC applications, you have to be in every year, even if they don't have money. There's a consistent, one of these days, if they do have money, you need to have been at the table in prior years.
Yes, you're absolutely right. If your oar is not in the water,
that's right.
You can't apply. If we didn't have a planning grant, we could never apply for an implementation grant.
Okay. Any further questions? Representative Shumper.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy and Dr. Lupker, I'm kind of interested in the data you're collecting on stroke. I had a stroke about 10 years ago, and I'm just wondering, what kind of information do you collect or plan on collecting about that?
Dr. Lupker?
Yes, the Health Department has looked and has created quite dramatic tables and pictures of the distribution of stroke mortality, that is, death from stroke, in the state, and it does differ by county and area, and this is the type of information that is very, very useful. In a broader sense, it would be nice to have hospital surveillance of strokes. We do not have that at the time. Most people survive, I know because I run an NIH program looking at this in the Twin Cities, but there is no statewide surveillance of non-fatal strokes.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? I did want to ask one question. You know, one of the recommendations, I think, in terms of CPR, trying to help people who are either having heart attacks or other kinds of life-threatening incidents like that, I know that the recommendations have changed. And I'm trying to remember the name of the intervention that sometimes is recommended now.
You're talking about AEDs or automatic defibrillators?
Yes, the defibrillators.
Right.
Having them on site. And I'm just wondering if you have any recommendations. I've often wondered, we don't have any, as far as I know, here in our state office building or at the Capitol. Maybe we do. I'm not aware of any. If anybody else is, you could correct me, but I believe that's now a recommendation, and I'm not sure if it's a recommendation of the American Heart Association or cardiologists in general, or what you think of that, but since we're sitting here today and we're talking about that, I thought I would ask your impression on that.
Yes, Madam Chairman, it is an interest of mine, and I served on the committee for the university because we have them in a number of settings in the university, perhaps 100 machines scattered around the university. And the Heart Association, because it is the main trainer of people and developer of policies for CPR, has a strong influence on what happens in this country and around the world. I have to say I'm very surprised that there's no AEDs here. I mean, the recommendation is that they should be used in places where there is a high concentration of people coming and going, where the average age of the population, unlike some of them we put in the dorms at the U, is not 21, where these are rare events, but more the adult population. And I won't talk about stress specifically, but, you know, I have to say I'm surprised because it's certainly Heart Association advocacy for this. It's policy in most large public buildings to have things like this, just as it is in sports stadiums, and I'm surprised you don't.
I think I'm being corrected here by our staff that there is one on the second floor. Representative Murphy, being one of the other nurses here, did you know we had this on site?
Madam Chair and members, I did not know.
Okay. So there are at least four nurses here in the house who perhaps we, I'm not sure if the other two knew. But I'm just thinking it's certainly not anything that only nurses can do, and it's something that we all probably maybe need to think about an orientation towards here. So I'm happy to be told that there is, that we do have a defibrillator here, and that maybe we all need to learn more about that.
Is it accessible?
So apparently on the second floor, by the receptionist, yes. And maybe this committee will take it upon ourselves to have a brief orientation session at the beginning of one of our meetings, just so we know. And I think, I mean, on a very serious note, it could be saving the lives of any of us or our colleagues. Or our constituents who come to visit.
Is there significance that it's on the second floor?
Oh, and there's also one on the sixth floor.
Oh.
You know, I'm sure the Heart Association would be helpful with training you.
Is that right?
If you needed our assistance in this. You know, a machine that's available and no one knows where it is not really available.
That's right. Thank you. Thank you. Representative Murphy, you've got more today here than you intended. I believe there's another question from Representative Eastland.
My question is
okay. Without any, Representative Murphy, Morgan.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I have a question. I know this is moved to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Yes.
I'm under the impression that when we do that, there's no need to take a vote on those bills independently. Is that correct?
That's correct. Representative Morgan, I was going to be talking about that today because yesterday when we did that with my bill, we took a vote and we only need to move it without objection.
Because we don't know what is going to be there.
And we don't know the number.
Anyway, yeah.
That's right.
So, okay, thank you.
Right. Thank you for that clarification. Any other questions? If not, then that is the motion before us, Representative Benson, that this House File 678 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Appropriations Committee bill being created here. And without objection, that will be done. So we'll be laying the bill over.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative Murphy.
Thank you.
Do you want to stay there for your second bill?
Yes, ma'am.
Representative Cram.
I move that we lay over House File 462 for inclusion.
House inclusion in the omnibus.
In the omnibus bill.
Mm-hmm. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm happy to introduce House File 462 on behalf of LifeTrack Resources. LifeTrack Resources is a long-standing nonprofit agency located right here in St. Paul. Their mission is to build better lives by working together to develop people's strengths. LifeTrack Resources provides family-to-family support services to families across Minnesota who have had a child who is deaf or hard of hearing. Originally started as a program for families in the metro area, the Parent Guide program was expanded in 2006 to have a parent guide in every region of Minnesota. In the past 5 years, newborn hearing screening began in every hospital in the state. New research is showing that if we find these children and get them into an effective program by the age of 6 months, children's language skills are the same as their peers by the age of 5. The parent guides provide parents with individual support, access to information, and connection to local parents to help them make critical decisions in a timely manner. House File 462 seeks an appropriation of $100,000 a year to maintain the parent-to-parent network in Greater Minnesota. To help provide further details about the program, I would like to introduce two witnesses. Candace Lindo Davies, a parent of a child who is deaf and the Family Support Coordinator of LifeTrack Resources, and then she will introduce Amy, our second witness. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you introduce yourself for the tape, please.
I'm Candace Lindo-Davies, and good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm the proud mother of an 11-year-old son who is profoundly deaf. I'm also privileged to be the coordinator of the Family Support Connection at LifeTrack Resources. We are a parent network for Minnesota families who have children who are deaf and hard of hearing. Today, I ask for your support for $100,000 in an annual partnership with the Minnesota Department of Health. The Family Support Connection was started at LifeTrack Resources in 2000 as primarily a metro service through funding provided by the Greater Twin Cities United Way. The past 5 years, the Minnesota Department of Health, charged with the task of implementing universal newborn hearing screening and an early intervention detection and intervention program, has contracted with LifeTrack Resources to provide parent-to-parent support throughout the state. Advancements in the identification of hearing loss and hearing technology have dramatically changed potential outcomes for our youth. Prior to this, children were not often identified until age 3 or 4, when their language development was already severely delayed. Now parents can be told their child's diagnosis soon after birth and are asked to make critical decisions almost immediately. Research confirms that within intervention by 6 months of age, children can develop language just shadowing their hearing peers. However, parents are often in shock still about their child's hearing loss, feeling overwhelmed by conflicting professional advice about choices, feeling isolated, especially in greater Minnesota. The Family Support Connections trained parent guides move parents beyond their grief, provide parents with emotional support and unbiased information about all communication, educational, and medical options. We can link families to one another, give them access to experts in the field, provide them with news about emerging issues and research, as well as offer a newsletter, lending library, and educational workshops. This means parents are better equipped to make decisions for their child. In 2006, the program expanded to include trained parent guides in every region of Minnesota and became the Minnesota chapter of a growing national organization, Hands and Voices. However, Department of Health funding will end in 2008 and currently does not fully cover the cost of our metro nor greater Minnesota parent guides. While corporate and foundation grants have helped support this project, consistency and continuation of the program requires a public investment. The cost savings of identifying and intervening with even one child would fully cover the full cost of a Family Support Connection for 1 year. We ask for your small investment in the future of our children who are deaf and hard of hearing, and invite you to listen to one parent's story. I'll introduce to you now Amy Deneen, our Southeast Parent Guide.
Welcome. Introduce yourself, please.
My name is Amy Deneen, and I'm also the proud parent of an 11-year-old son with a moderate hearing loss. Matthew was identified not until he was 3.5 years old. At that time, we were living in Grand Rapids, Minnesota. I can remember the day we were given his diagnosis. We felt totally overwhelmed by and unprepared for the news. We had no family history of hearing loss, which left us asking, how did this happen and what in the world do we do now? The school did their best to present communication options and educational options to us, but what we really needed was a parent to connect with. Someone who had been down this road, who understood what we were going through and what to expect in the future. Problem was, our family was the only one in the area. There was no one to connect with. We finally found the Family Support Connection at LifeTrack Resources about 6 years ago when we were in the Twin Cities and attended an AWARE Fair, which was an event that showcased organizations and products for deaf and hard of hearing persons. We ended up moving our family closer to the Twin Cities, actually to Red Wing, so that we could get the support we needed for our family through having access to other families who had children with hearing loss. We began attending social and educational events at LifeTrack Resources. I'll never forget the smile on Matt's face when for the first time he met other children wearing hearing aids just like him, or other sons meeting and playing with other siblings who shared the same increased responsibility of having a brother or a sister with a hearing loss. And we got to talk with the parents to share ideas, frustrations, and most importantly, share the successes. This program is so needed in greater Minnesota. The isolation of these families in rural communities is great. The other families are out there. However, they won't know of each other without a statewide parent network and a trained parent who knows the resources of each community. The family support connection has been vital for our family, and because of that, I accepted the role as a Southeast parent guide. The importance of local support became clear to me on Monday evening. I received a call from one of the parents I'd been working with for the past few months on finding hearing aid funding for their child. She had been overwhelmed by the cost of hearing aids and how they would pay the bill. She called to thank me. Through our efforts, they found the funding. It was like the weight of the world had been lifted from her shoulders. Now they can focus on this new little baby they have, and that's the way it should be. The families don't have to pave the road, they just need a map. The parent guides provide the map. I urge you to support the appropriation of funds for Family Support Connection in Minnesota Hands and Voices. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dineen. Any questions from committee members? Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just on the bill. I'm just reading. It said the commissioner may contract with a nonprofit. I assume that it's LifeTrack Resources is the nonprofit that we're talking about here. Is that the? I guess then my question is just kind of informational. What are all of the sources of funding that LifeTrack Resources has? I mean, where does your funding flow come from now? Federal? Not, I mean, are you coming from? How does that work?
Thank you, Representative. Yes, LifeTrack Resources Force specifically, this program does have several different sources of funding, the majority of which, though, is from the Greater Twin Cities United Way. And, of course, that's our concern, is as we're growing and expanding into outstate Minnesota, the expectation for Greater Twin Cities United Way to pay for an outstate program is rather too demanding. So we do have some funds that help seed this expansion for the first year, but that money is dwindling, and so we are actively looking for other grants to sustain the program, but we need consistency and we need a commitment now in order to make sure that this program that's already proven to be successful won't go away. But the majority of the funding is Greater Twin Cities United Way and then also private foundations. There's a healthy amount of that.
One follow-up question, Madam Chair. Are there any federal funding sources that are involved that could be tapped for this use?
Thank you. The only federal funding that we receive is really a pass-through. Department of Health gets federal funding for their newborn hearing screening program. The Department of Health has shared some of that money with us. As I mentioned, that money is coming to a halt, and so those federal dollars will dry up in 2008. So we have a larger problem, too, as far as funding that program, but that's the only federal funding. I'm not aware of any that would be available for this program at the time.
Let me just clarify for myself your question. So this program, which has been funded partly by a state funding and federal funding, is not in the governor's budget for refunding again. Is that correct?
No, it is not. Not sure.
Okay. So it's eliminated. All right. And so, again, as in the last bill, if this committee doesn't find the money to come forward with the appropriations here, this particular program would come to an end in terms of public funding. And it would be United Way funding that would continue with it? Or?
Yes, Madam Chair. The funding from Greater Twin Cities United Way would remain. It would be the funding from the federal government passed into the state through the Department of Health that would be coming to an end in 2008. So the greatest risk would be for the continuation of the outstate program. The Metro program is funded. It's the outstate program that would go away. And, of course, we want parents to have access to this program regardless of where they live.
Just to clarify, the reason that the Metro program would continue is because of private fundraising.
Right. Correct.
Okay. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Lindlow or the other testifier, what do you currently do with the money? How is it used? Do the folks use the internet? Do you have a program or something like? What do they do currently? How do you use the money?
Yes, Representative. We use the money by hiring trained parent guides who go through extensive training to be able to work with families in this state that they're in, and to be able to deliver information in an unbiased fashion. So a good part of it goes to the infrastructure and the training and the staff. We also do educational workshops for parents We have a website. We have a email distribution. We get out information about, you know, research and events that are happening. We do a newsletter. We have a lending library. We have fact sheets, and we go to pretty much every workshop and seminar you can think of that relates to children with hearing loss. So we are pretty much involved on a systems level, all the way down from federal, state, and then local as well. So it's quite a bit that we do for the money that we get. We've really worked on one full-time equivalent for the past 6 years. And just with the extension of the program into the greater Minnesota, we've just added almost one person. But it's been two people.
Madam Chair, if I can follow up. So you have like the equivalent of one-time FTE, but I'm assuming that wouldn't include the parents in the outstate area, or would that include like the testifier? That's separate. So a good part of the $200,000 would be used to compensate parents in Grand Rapids or Red Wing,
correct,
wherever they live, to be able to be available to communicate with other parents. And like, how many folks do you get for the $200,000, and like, how are they spread out as such?
Yeah, Representative, we have six parent guides that are stationed in six regions in greater Minnesota, and so that $100,000 per year would pay for their salaries to be working in those remote locations. And it does funnel some money back into the metro, because we do a lot of centralized services. All the materials that we have, the website and everything, of course, is out of the metro office. So so that money is used for those six trained guides.
I do have another question, and I don't know if this is for Ms. Lindell or maybe for Ms. Deneen, or both of you. I was talking with a grandparent yesterday who was lobbying on behalf of this bill, and she pointed out to me that newborn screening is very lacking in terms of you know, just trying to see if there is any loss of hearing or deficiency in hearing. And this is the problem. I think one of you mentioned that your child was 3 years old, I believe, before they were diagnosed. Is this your impression throughout the state that even though we have a screening program at the Minnesota Department of Health, it is not adequately functioning or funded or reaching the right people? Or what's the issue here? Can you help us know a little bit more about that?
Right now we're one of, what, four states that doesn't have a mandate for newborn hearing screening. And because we're one of those four states, there's a couple of really big hospitals in the state that don't feel the need to report their results. And I believe at the summit it was discussed that there's a huge gap in between how many children you would think would be identified with a hearing loss and how many children are actually reported in Minnesota with a hearing loss. And they're problem solving on ways that you can come up with the reason for the gap. So I still think there's a lot of kids that may not be getting identified. Again, I also work at our local hospital, and I've been real active in getting them, the professionals, the pediatricians, to see the need for newborn hearing screening, and I don't think that it's always followed through upon, because it's not being impressed upon the parents the importance. So I do think the state has some issues there.
And I don't know, Ms. Lindell, if you can tell us, or others who may be more familiar with this, maybe somebody from the health department or Ms. Hartnett, you know, what's our state's history in trying to look at this? Have there been bills to mandate newborn screening? Have they been defeated? Where are we at with this issue?
Madam Chair, I'd like to introduce Mary Hartnett from the Minnesota Commission Serving Deaf and Hard of Hearing People. She's actively involved in this issue.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Mary Hartnett. I'm with the Minnesota Commission Serving Deaf and Hard of Hearing People. And actually, I didn't come prepared to testify today, but I actually could pass around a map or a chart of the United States that shows that we are one of five states that is in the unsatisfactory category, according to the CDC, in reporting and identifying infants with hearing loss to the Department of Health. 10 years ago, the Commission came forward with the bill to try to get a mandate for infant screening, and we would have been one of the few states in the country that would have been providing this or would have had a hearing screening mandate. Since that time, over the course of 10 years, almost every state has a hearing screening mandate. And why is it important? For a number of the reasons that the parents that are here have stated. Kids are graduating with about a mean reading level of third grade 8 months that are deaf and hard of hearing with normal intelligence. If they're screened at birth, they have a chance at having normal language development. The research shows that there's no gap between their chronological age and their language acquisition. So we should be identifying about 240 kids in the state. Last year, in fiscal year 06, we identified the Department of Health had 62 kids reported to the Department of Health, and then the Department of Education had 22 kids with primary hearing loss, birth to three, so are reported to them during that fiscal year. So we surveyed the hospitals and asked them why some of them weren't reporting. They said because of a liability issue, there will be legislation coming forward this year that's been, you know, come through a coalition of individuals through our commission to look for a mandate and the supports that parents need to have in place in order to be able to have the kids be successful. It's one thing to have the mandate in place, but then you need to have the supports in place.
Thank you. It's very interesting to know that there is a built-in process, and legislators who might want to support it can see,
right,
see you.
Right, and a hearing aid bank that Representative Huntley will be sponsoring for immediate amplification for kids, a statewide coordinator that Representative Slavik will be bringing forward, and then there's a parent mentor that, or deaf and hard of hearing mentors that Representative Fritz will be bringing forward, all that are evidence-based practices that lead to successful outcomes for kids.
Okay. Representative Moe has a question, and maybe this.
Madam Chair.
Don't leave it, because I have another one when we're done.
Just a real brief question. Thank you for bringing this to our attention. I'm not an attorney. I'm just kind of a rockhead physical education teacher, so you might have to just speak more plainly for me.
You said it.
Yeah, right. I know. So there's a liability concern for reporting children with that are hard of hearing?
From the hospitals to the Department of Health.
That just doesn't make any sense to me. Can you?
You'd have to speak with hospitals. I can't respond to that. When we did the survey, we hired an intern and asked them to survey the hospitals, asked why some of them weren't reporting, and that was the number one reason, was because of the concern over the liability issue of screening and then reporting to the Department of Health.
Seems like a catch-all for, Madam Chair, sorry, a catch-all for just not wanting to do it.
If I recall, Representative Murphy, did you have a comment on that?
Madam Chair, I just was going to comment that it's a privacy issue.
Right.
They're afraid to release information without proper consent from the parents, and having to take the extra efforts and culturally sensitive informed consent and blah, blah, blah.
I think we've been invited to tour the health department lab, and I think one of the things that I've understood they're most proud of is some of the screening that they do, newborn screening. So I guess this wasn't quite computed. I think we have to figure out. I have to understand a little bit more here what the issues are. Okay, so I guess we got some more questions here too. Representative Shumpert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a numbers person. How many kids are we talking about that you're working with? How many kids are born every year in Minnesota with deafness?
Sure, Representative. There's about 210 children that should be identified through newborn hearing screening every year. We're not finding that many because of the reporting problem, but that's how many there should be based on our birth numbers. As far as how many families we serve in our program, last year we served 492 families and professionals, unduplicated. That's just direct service. People calling, we respond, and then there's about 800 or so families and professionals that are on our listservs and get our newsletters on a regular basis and so on. So we do a lot for a little. A lot of volunteer work.
We need the infrastructure in place. As we move from a voluntary system of reporting from the hospitals to the Department of Health, we need infrastructure in place to support these families. So without a mandate, this many families are getting the support, the need will increase when the mandate gets, or I hope when the mandate gets passed.
One question I'd like to ask is, I believe one of the important things that Ms. Dean talked about was connecting the family with resources to be able to get the hearing aids and so on. And
Can you just review for us what coverage there is for families in terms of either health insurance, medical assistance, or not?
Madam Chair, we got a hearing aid bill passed a few years back. Unfortunately, it doesn't cover all children. It covers what, state-sponsored health plans, or everything but employee-sponsored health plans, where employers get to pick and choose their coverage. So there's a lot of families out there yet with this type of coverage, and they don't have hearing aid coverage in place. So what we've done with our family is my husband will go and he'll lobby his human resources department and say, hey, add this to your coverage. And so far we've been successful in them doing that. Other families who don't have hearing loss in their family, they're not expecting the hearing loss, and then this baby's born and they need hearing aids, which can cost up to $4,000 for the pair, and they just don't have that kind of money laying around. So then they start thinking, what am I going to do? So there's different foundations out there that'll provide funding. If the child qualifies for medical assistance, then they get funding that way. But there's still a portion of families out there who just don't have any resources to pay. So you have fundraisers, you have donations from local clubs like Sertoma and the Lions Club. But the need out there is still pretty great.
Thank you. Okay, unless there's any further questions, Representative McFarland.
Madam Chair, sorry I was late. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if this was covered or not, but are health care providers required to tell the health department about children who have hearing loss due to injuries or ear infections, you know, as they grow older?
Ms. Linda?
Thank you, Representative. I'm not aware of there being any requirement by any health care provider to report to the Department of Health. In fact, the newborn hearing screening program really focuses on children in their early year, you know, so by the first year of life. So there really isn't any reporting system that I'm aware of even after that. And like I said, this is a voluntary system at this time. So.
Okay. All right, thank you. If there's any further question, Representative Kranz moves his motion, the House file 462 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus committee bill. Any further discussion? Without objection, bill is laid over.
Madam Chair and members, thank you very much for your time. It's really cool to come before a committee and talk about prevention.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Murphy. Next, Representative Otremba.
Madam Chair.
President Morgan.
While we're waiting for the next presenter, I'd like to move the minutes of the February 13th meeting.
Thank you, Representative Morgan. Has anybody had a chance to look at the minutes? Okay, is there any discussion? If not, the motion is before us to approve those minutes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails, and the minutes are adopted. Thank you. Representative Morgan.
And then I'd like to move House File 315 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you. Representative Morgan moves House File 315 be included for the passed for inclusion and possible inclusion in this committee's omnibus finance bill. Representative Otremba, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Today you are hearing the House File 315, which I call the prevention bill for suicide. Suicide is the second leading cause of death for 15 to 30 year olds and the 10th leading cause of death for people of all ages. Males comprise approximately 82% of all suicide deaths. The suicide rate for American Indians is 2 times higher than any other racial group. Of all age groups, 75 to 84 years have the highest suicide rates. Persons aged 45 to 54 have the second highest rates. Non-fatal hospitalized injuries are highest among females aged 10 to 44. Suicide is preventable. We have effective tools to get resources, information to people when we fund the effort. We funded in the past, but currently we have no funding. This bill would restore funding for grants that were eliminated in 2005.
And I think you have a book in your file that also says there are a lot more pieces of suicide information in the suicide prevention plan report. So I would like to defer to Will Wilson.
Welcome to the committee. If you introduce yourself, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Will Wilson from the Mental Health Association, and I'd like to thank Representative Otremba for bringing this bill forward. I just wanted to give some very brief testimony and then pass it off to some experts to give maybe some more depth on the issue. Compared to other states, Minnesota is, as far as rates of suicide, Minnesota is about in the middle. But our efforts to prevent suicide are quite literally at the bottom compared to other states. When the grants were cut in 2005, that basically meant that a lot of groups around the state that were receiving grant funds basically lost traction. And also I have, unfortunately, an update to the document that's in your packets, the executive summary. If you look on the left side, the second to last bullet says that there are three times as many deaths from suicide as there are from homicide. That's actually four times as many now. So the need is still there, and we need to continue our effort. As Representative Otremba said, suicide is preventable. We do have evidence-based practices around the state that do prevent suicide. All we need to do is fund it. We're asking for $1.1 million a year, and when that was fully funded and up and running, there were about 13 grantees around the state that were targeting various populations, geographic areas, and demographics. We also need to do this year, because 2 years ago when the grants were funded, when they were eliminated, the department did stay in contact with all of the grantees, and there's a very tenuous relationship between the department and the grantees. If we wait for another budget cycle, I think that those relationships will not exist anymore. So we really do ask for your commitment this year to help prevent suicide. Thank you.
Mr. Wilson, did you have some other witnesses, Senator Trumbull, that you wanted to bring forward?
Why don't all three of you come down together so it's facilitated a little quickly?
Thank you. And as you each speak, if you'll just identify yourself for the tape, please.
Hello. I'm Al Klusner. I'm not a lobbyist. I'm a concerned parent. I lost two children to suicide. My daughter in 1985, she's a 3-9 student at the University of Iowa, and she was a profound athlete the whole bit. She came home when Mary and I, my wife and I, were in Florida, and she suicided. In 1997, my son, who was 38 at the time, graduated from the University of Wisconsin in Madison, was a broker for Merrill Lynch for a while, number three producer. When he suicided, you wouldn't have hired him to clean up this floor. And what I'm saying is that Michael had bipolar disease. Amy had clinical depression. Now, this is important because what's important is that clinical depression is considered a disease, a brain disease. And this was exemplified and really pointed out in 1998 in Reno when a group of suicide survivors, the federal government and state governments, had a conference. And at that time, at the conclusion of that conference, our Surgeon General, Dr. Satcher, said suicide is a public health problem. It's not a behavioral problem. It's a public health problem. And that's the real, real big thing. So what happened after that conference is that the group from Minnesota that was very active in that group, people from the Department of Health, Department of Human Service, and I really think education was there also. We came back, and I did a little research on this, I mean pretty detailed research, to find out the history of suicides in this state. And thanks to the legislative body, and it was suggested by Paul Wellstone and by Jim Ramstad, that if you want to get things done, really go to the legislative body. And I was looking for a couple of million dollars at that time, and Senator Kincaid and Linda Bordeaux, I believe it was, yes, that worked on this, and said, let's get $100,000 to study the problem. And this is the report. You probably, and what was very interesting about that is that we had a trigger date. And that was very keen on the legislators' part, that they have to report to the Department of Health by January the 15th on the findings. Otherwise, these things go on and on and on. What's interesting about Minnesota is that if you look at other states, they continue to study the problem. Is it a problem? Is it a problem? Is it a problem? We took a different approach after this study. We said that, well, the whole world, especially in the U.S., we know it's a problem. We have 30,000 deaths a year. So we worked with the Department of Health. We put together legislation to fund community-oriented groups to do this. And that's really what happened. I want to show you this sheet. You don't have to read it all, but I'd like you to look at the yellow part. You can't see it very well. But in that year, we had... What, are you going to magnify that? Oh, aren't you nice? This is my assistant. I love it. But in that year, Governor Ventura, who wrote in Playboy magazine all different things, and one of the lines he said is that suicide people are cowards. Governor Ventura signed this bill, and we had $1.1 million. We asked for eight. We got $1.1 million per year over 4 years, and he signed that bill. We had a very interesting, if you will, commissioners at that time. He wanted to go wrestle or whatever. So he had very strong commissioners. Jan Malcolm, and I think it was O'Keefe at the time, the commissioner at Human Services. They really became proactive on this, and we got this bill passed. Now, what did that do? And by the way, at that period of time, 3 years ago, we were considered across America as the gold standard. We were the first state of the 50 to have funding, not to study, but to do things. And you know, it's remarkable. I mean, people from New York, from Rhode Island, I mean, we would talk, you know, frankly, across the country, and I've been in Washington on this same issue several times. We were considered the gold standard. During that period of time, now it's in addition to this work, we exceeded the suicide reduction rate by 19%. In 2005, we accelerated the national rate. We lost our gold standard, and as Will suggested earlier, we are at the bottom of the heap, and this is part of this. Now, I mean, this thing is part of it, this bill. I want to show you one other thing, if I may. Will mentioned, again, you can't see this very well, but let me tell you what it says. 39 organizations applied for grants from the Department of Health. And if you total up what they were requesting, it was something like $8.5 million. And that's a lot of money, but out of $32 billion, it isn't too bad. So then we went up a little bit further, and 13 grants were given. And You can't see this very well, but this this suicide prevention work went into various cultures. Money for Hmong, for Hmong suicide prevention. Money for American Indian, probably using incorrect words, but you know where I am. For African American areas, for the elder, for the young people. I mean, this was a very, very good deal. And what they bought into, and it was difficult to do at the time, and I really commend the Department of Health for this. They got commitments for a four-year program to be doing things. They were not, well, 1 year it's over. It was a sequential type process to do things. Now, we had a change in leadership at the highest level in the state. I've attempted frequently to get to the governor's office. I couldn't. But I did get to the Department of Health's office. There was a different structure in terms of what I call the free spirit of commissioners. They were following the mandates, da-da-da-da-da, is the way I felt about it. And the Amys don't have to die. I think I will point that out. Just, this is a sidebar. 90 to 95% of the people who suicide have a psychiatric illness or a brain disease. 60% of those have clinical depression, which is the lower end, and schizophrenia being the other one. So when I look at this bill and what we did, I don't worry about the Michaels. I do worry about the Michaels. He had bipolar. But I really want to go where the numbers are, and that was in clinical depression. So we were working on that. This is what was negated. After attempting to get to the correct people, I did get to Linda Berg on this. She said, yeah, well, it's not going to work. But I have to show you this. Two more sheets and I'm done here. Where is that? So what I did is I went to the Star Tribune. And at this time, the Star Tribune, I think the date there is April the 8th, 2005. They wrote a beautiful editorial. And they said, don't stop funding the bill. I mean, we were trying to be visible on this. We had support from the St. Paul papers from all over the area. And it was ignored in a very, what I call, cavalier fashion. The other thing we did in that bill, and I might point out that Senator Foley, and at the time Piper was in the Senate, and what they had in the state of Minnesota, it was a criminal event to suicide. In other words, they could throw Andy and Michael in jail. Unfortunately, they're dead. Senator Foley, you know, got rabid about this, so when we put in that bill, we cleaned up some of the language in the state. Now, hard data. You want hard data? I'll show you some hard data. This is the last of the last. At the time we got our bill passed, we looked at suicides. And if you look at the chart, we had 997, 492 deaths. DWIs were 77, AIDS deaths were 77, and homicides 180. In the year after that, we had 488 deaths in Minnesota. That's when we were the star of all the states in the country. Then look at 2005 or 2004. This comes directly from the Department of Health's epidemiology area. This is the highest number we ever had in this state. And I'm not saying that's all dependent upon this bill, but we used to permeate the state on suicide being a health issue and not a behavioral issue. If you have an Alzheimer problem, it's not called Alzheimer behavioral problems. It's called a disease. And that's in one part of the brain. When you get into clinical depression, there's a very sleight of hand, they call it as a behavioral problem. There are many things. We need the $2.2 million to reestablish our credibility, and again, I think to take a, what I call a leadership role in the country for what we do. And the AMEs do not have to die. We can, 67% of the people that are treated for clinical depression, a study just completed by NIMH, can be treated effectively. We're not talking only medicine. We're talking talk therapy as well as medical work. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Klusner. Next witness,
good morning. I'm Rachel Schott, and thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for your time here this morning. I'm the Executive Director of the Yellow Ribbon Suicide Prevention Program in Minnesota, and in 1997, I lost my youngest brother to suicide as well. His name was Aaron, and he was a sophomore at Mankato West High School. That was 9 years ago. Today, I'm here with my daughter, Amara. She was 3 years old when my brother died. She's also got a friend here with her today. And, you know, I can't do anything to bring my brother back, but all of us can go forward and try to help our children and other families not to have to endure the kind of pain that my family and Al's family have had to endure over these many years since we've lost loved ones to suicide. Our program seeks to save and enrich lives through the use of education, advocacy, and support. And I represent countless supporters and partners across the state, including our youth boards that number over 200 members. That number is down from over 400 just 2 years ago, since our program was being funded by state grants. I'd like to share a bit of background about how we came to that place, but Al did that for me already, so I don't have to do that. The cuts that Al spoke to are truly cuts that our families in the state cannot afford. If you could see the face of the defeated husband that's been into my office over the last several months since his wife died by suicide in November, leaving behind 3 college-age students, or if you could hear the desperation of the sobs of the mother who buried her only son who died by suicide, if you could feel the immense pain of the father who just buried his daughter, you'd know that these cuts have gone too deep to erode the infrastructure that we've worked to build. And you'd know that we need to do more and not less. I know that you're all elected officials who make important decisions every day, and I don't envy you those decisions. Those decisions affect people's lives, and the decisions about this funding are decisions that are life and death decisions. Some statistics have been shared with you this morning, but I would reiterate, suicide is the second leading cause of death for our 15 to 29-year-olds, and it's the third leading cause of death for our 10 to 14-year-olds. These are our babies. They're our children. Under the former grants program, we had community-based grantees across the state implement evidence-based strategies that targeted our high-risk populations across the lifespan. That's really important. They came directly from the state plan. This is a state plan document that Al showed you, and that document already exists. We already have the plan. We already have the evidence-based strategies. It already exists. We don't have to recreate it. We've worked collaboratively to create that plan and to build the capacity of communities across the state to implement those evidence-based strategies for suicide prevention programming. As an organization, Yellow Ribbon has worked side-by-side with Suicide Awareness Voices of Education and the Minnesota Department of Health, as well as countless other partners, since the Ventura administration first funded the study, which resulted in our state plan. Most recently, Yellow Ribbon, SAVE, and the Minnesota Department of Health worked in a partnership as a technical assistance team, providing training and expertise to grantees and communities across the state in the last round of grants. As part of those grants, we provided train-the-trainer training to hundreds of persons and communities across the state who continue to use the materials and the training to educate their communities about symptoms of depression, warning signs for suicide, and important protective factors. But the capacity of those communities who receive the training has been eroded since the funding cuts. And before we lose any more of the precious infrastructure we worked so hard to build, we need to urge you to act. I could go on for pages telling you of the successful outcomes of all of these different grant programs. We have a plan. We knew that that plan that was created had a price tag. We know the dollars in the state are limited. We know, though, that we have to start somewhere. We began to build this infrastructure and target high-risk populations, and as our funding has been chiseled away, so has our suicide rate begun to climb in this state. As our numbers in 2004, went over that 500 death mark, and Al showed you the 2004 numbers, but in 2005, that number climbed still further to 542 suicide deaths. Compare that to approximately 197 drunk driving deaths, or 138 homicides, or 51 AIDS-related deaths. Where are we spending our money? We must fund efforts that tackle this very, very important public health problem. We have the passion, we have the plan, we have the evidence-based strategies. Please help us to fund this work. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Scott.
Hi, good morning. Yes. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Dr. Dan Rydenberg, and I'm the Executive Director of SAVE, Suicide Awareness Voices of Education, as Rachel had mentioned. I'm also the Managing Director of the National Council for Suicide Prevention, a group of 11 national organizations all sharing a mission to prevent suicide. With that, I bring you both a state and a national perspective on this particular issue. SAVE is a nonprofit organization with the mission to prevent suicide. We represent clinicians, researchers, and advocates, but we also speak for thousands of Minnesota constituents, many of whom are survivors, parents and siblings, coworkers, and neighbors who have lost a loved one to suicide. We speak to you intimately knowing about suicide and what it is like to live as a survivor. As a therapist, I have lost two clients to suicide. I've sat on rooftops with clients who are threatening and attempting to take their life. I also lost my best friend to suicide as a child. As you've heard, with suicide being the third leading cause of death for our youth, with more than 500 suicides and an estimated 3 to 12,000 more attempts annually alone in this state, we must do everything we can to raise awareness, educate, and help those in need to prevent unnecessary loss of life. We know that local communities must take more responsibility for suicide prevention because state government cannot do it alone. We also understand that government spending must be held down. However, some spending on a life and death issue is necessary. Suicide is, as you heard this morning, a public health issue that deserves and needs government involvement, and it should be in the state budget. State and federal involvement on this issue has repeatedly been recommended by the U.S. Surgeon General, the President's New Freedom Commission, and Healthy People 2010. Suicide is a complex and multifaceted public health issue. That said, research has documented that mental disorders are involved in 90% of suicides. Depression and the depressive phase of a bipolar disorder have been found in an average of 60% of suicides. Research has consistently found that psychotherapy combined with medication is the most effective treatment for depression and consequently for preventing depression and consequently for preventing suicide. However, work must be done to raise awareness of the warning signs and symptoms of these issues so that we can get to people with life-saving treatment. We know much about risk factors, warning signs. We know much about protective factors. We need to raise awareness and reduce stigma. As survivors and experts in suicide, we implore you to fund suicide prevention efforts in this state. In this state, for every suicide, the average work loss cost for every suicide in 2001 was staggering, $1,209,911. Minnesota hospital charges for suicide attempts increased from $28 million in 2001 to over $48.2 million in 2004. Over the last 5 years, there has been a steady increase in suicide in this state. These are alarming trends that need your attention. Funding for raising awareness, education, training, and technical assistance are just a few of the major issues we propose to continue working on collaboratively with the Department of Health. All we need is your financial support. You have the power to save lives for this and for future generations in renewing the Suicide Prevention Grant Program. I'd leave you with this. If you knew that your son or daughter, your husband or your wife were suffering from a treatable medical disease, but they were afraid to seek treatment or didn't know treatment was available, and their illness got worse to the point of suicide, how would you feel? You'd want something done about it. Please help us make it easier, not more difficult, to get this information to our citizens, and in turn, you will save lives. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Redenberg. Representative Swales, have you got a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I just want to say thank you to each of the testifiers. I know that when personal tragedy strikes, that oftentimes that's the impetus for a life's vocation. And it seems to me that you have taken these tragedies and turned them into something passionate and hopefully that will be redemptive for many, many other lives. And thank you so much for what you've done. I just want to speak from my experience as a public school teacher. Last year, one of my AP students committed suicide, and he was a talented, brilliant young man who ran with the best students in the school, and everybody was stunned at his death. And I'm still somewhat bothered by the fact that I was probably not more sensitive to him. I was very close to this student, and so I have my own demons to deal with in the regards to his death. I do want to say, though, that the Yellow Ribbon Project swept our school, and that for months after his death, students wore yellow ribbons continuously, and they were very present at the graduation ceremonies when the seniors graduated last spring. Your work has not been in vain, and even though there was a funding cut there, what you have done has made a tremendous impact on our communities. I can remember early in my teaching career when we would lose students that there was a certain amount of hysterical chaos that would sweep through the schools, but now because of the kind of work that you have provided to professionals in the communities, there is immediate support to our student body, and I do know that what you have done is helped to provide comfort and support, and also you have provided a tremendous amount of knowledge to the professionals who deal on an ongoing basis with this, and probably you have also prevented copycat suicide. So please know that what you are doing is important. And I hope that everybody here today listened very carefully, that this is a public health concern and something that we should be taking very seriously. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Stevenson?
Thank you, thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess just a couple questions. Start with a statement. I'm a substitute teacher, and I was in Sartell High School when there was a young man who committed suicide, and it is a huge impact on the whole student body. It's a real concern. It's a real issue. And so I applaud your willingness to take this issue on. One of the questions I have is on a federal side. I think my memory serves me that when this initially was put in place, there were federal dollars that we were going after. And how successful was that? And can you give us a little background on that?
Sure. The Garrett Lee Smith funding was federal funding. Senator Smith lost his son, and the federal government said that there could be $87 million for the states to use for suicide prevention funding. That came out in 2005 and actually was $11.5 million that was actually allocated to or appropriated to be spent. Of that, $7.5 million was granted to states across the country. Originally, there were 14 states that received that money. The second year of the Garrett Lee Smith funding, we were able to increase to 29 states receiving grants and 55 college campuses and 7 tribal organizations across the country. The state grants were each $400,000 for 3 years. Currently, those funds are not going to be renewed. They are one-time, 3-year grants. And Minnesota did not receive in either of its two applications funding.
Madam Chair, just follow up. And I think in the legislative initiatives that we were looking at, in this particular one, we funded it through 2004. I think the initiative was that the federal dollars would begin to picked up with this initiative, and that it wasn't so much a just, we don't think this is an issue, but we were looking to other sources of funding, so we did not put it in the budget, if I'm correct on that issue. So I think there was, you know, I don't know that it was out of malice as much as it was we thought the funding source was going to be picked up on another side. Well, did you want to speak to that?
I was on the committee at the time that that was happening, and there really wasn't any sort of glimmer that we really were going to get those grant dollars. We knew that they were going to be there, available, but we knew that we had a slim chance to none to get them.
Madam Chair.
Okay, just I think, why don't you go ahead and have a chair there. Can we get another chair for
Madam Chair?
Mr. Klesner?
Yes.
Just 1 second. I want to make sure you can sit down so you can speak into the microphone.
Well, I can.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Al Klesner again. Thank you very much for a very good question. At the time that bill was passed, and by the way, a Kennedy-Wellstone bill was passed 2 years previously but never funded. It was for $57 million. And then when Mr. Smith or Senator Smith came with the bill, as Dan mentioned, there were strings tied. And the strings tied to that bill did not go into communities like we were in. Regarding the state. They were primarily used for colleges and universities screening, and we were so far ahead of the curve, as Dan again spoke, there's no way that we were that. It had nothing to do, and this presentation was made to the Department of Health, that the Smith funds would not be available. Mm-hmm. Those comments were ignored, or if you were not pursued, and they were comparing apples with oranges. The administration, in all aspects of it, did not follow up on what that bill really contained, in my opinion. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Wilson?
Madam Chair, members, thank you. In response to the representative question, I think generally when the federal government looks to help out in a state effort, they look for a commitment on the state level so that they can braid funding from the federal, the state, and the local communities. And currently our state's commitment is zero. So that might weigh on the federal government's mind as they're considering whether or not to fund us.
Again, can I just clarify, it's been zero since 2005, is that right? All right, thank you. Representative Shumper, please? Right.
Yeah,
ma'am.
Shumper,
then.
Oh, thanks, Madam Chair. You're saying the rate of suicide is going up. Do you have any good guesses as to why?
You know, that's a really very good question. It's a difficult question to answer. The National Violent Death Reporting System is only in 16 states currently. So we have some data, and it's better than before, but it's not very good. In Minnesota, we do pretty well. The problem is that on a national level, there is no consistency amongst medical examiners or coroners as to how they report death. So there are many people who died that we don't know were actually suicides. They can be listed as an accidental overdose, car accidents very often, unless there's a very clear indication or a note found in a car, won't be listed as a suicide. So what we know is that as the state has worked hard to raise awareness of the issue, more people have been willing to speak about it, and more has been reported by medical examiners, but yet not enough.
Madam Chair, but you must have some ideas of why more people would want to commit suicide in this society today.
I don't think that there's long been a history of thought in this country that suicide was a very conscious choice and that it was something that somebody wanted to do. The reality is that when somebody is suffering with a brain illness like this, The brain shuts down its the body. It shuts down all the organs, the muscles, the bones, and everything until the point that it doesn't have anything left to do to get out of its pain. So it shuts itself off, and that is what suicide is. Suicide is a result of many factors, not just genetic and biological, so there's a family history component to suicide, but a biological chemical imbalance in the brain, most often with serotonin and norepinephrine. We know that. We also know that environmental stress, occupational stressors, educational stressors, and family stressors impact on suicide. There isn't one thing that happens that leads a person to suicide. So when people ask, why are the numbers going up? It's not because just one thing is happening, like the economy is worse, or they're suffering more with a mental illness. It is a combination of things that take place that lead somebody to suicide.
Representative Moe?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Ochumba, for bringing this bill forward. A couple things. First, we had a family crisis regarding suicide not too long ago. So for me, this is personal. But in northern Minnesota, Representative Ochumba mentioned this, Native American population rate of suicide is twice the state average. And in particular, immediately following the tragedy at Red Lake High School, there was an acute case of suicide attempts and successes, I think about 10 in a span of a period of weeks, which is very obviously very concentrated. So my question is twofold. One, would this program be reinstating grants that previously existed, or would it be available for new programs? We actually have a new suicide prevention coordinator that's funded through a grant, local grant in Bemidji, looking at mostly Native issues. That's my first question. And then the second would there be any assistance for kind of this almost an epidemic case? Would there be possibly an acute response team or effort or something like that, perhaps, that could be coordinated through the Department of Health for events like what were going on in Red Lake in 2005 and 6?
Madam Chair, I can take the first question. I spoke with the department yesterday, and according to the point person on this, they would go through another RFP process, and so there would be some existing grantees that would probably receive funding again. Others have kind of had to adjust and have laid off staff, but there would be the chance to incorporate some new innovative programs as well.
With respect to the second question, yes, the technical assistance team that Rachel spoke about with the state between our organizations is very similar to that, and we are available and could be made available to other communities. We have worked hard to try to get to the people in Red Lake and around Red Lake, and currently there is an existing program out of CentraCare in St. Cloud where psychiatrists fly in on weekends. It has taken quite a long time to build up an alliance with the Native American community. However, the goal with that kind of model is something that we'd like to try to replicate across the state so that we could prevent further contagion, which is prevalent among youth.
Okay, we have three more questions, and we're running out of time, but we'll try to get to each of those questions, Representative Severson Lane and Eastland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just kind of a procedural question on this. From a lot of what I'm hearing here, this is obviously a behavioral issue, and I'm wondering whether this committee would have jurisdiction over that budget or not, if that would be the Mental Health Committee. And I'm just a process question here, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, this is included in Representative Greiling's bill also, which is kind of a sort of an omnibus mental health bill that was put together by the Mental Health Legislative Network. The reason that the bill is here is because this is where the funding would happen. And we did take testimony on Friday about this bill in the Mental Health Division, so they're aware of it.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When we're talking about increasing suicides, it seems to me that there's two parts to that. One is circumstances happening to an individual, and the other is the support system around them or in the culture. So would you agree that our problem here perhaps is the lack of education and awareness and assistance around them that would be able to nip it in the bud.
But the heads are shaking yes. Can we put that for the tapes?
Yes, certainly we would agree with that statement. And part of our educational programming and the evidence-based programs that were part of these community-based grants address that very issue.
Thank you, Chuck. President Eastland?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just trying to get my arms around just some of the trends, and we're using the term evidence based. This would be really a tough issue to establish evidence based practice. I mean, I don't know how you would do that necessarily, but I guess the question that I have is could I just get you to give me some information that I think might be interesting to see, because we can talk about the number of suicides, but I think a more valuable statistic is the rate. And could we get for our purposes a chart that would show us the rate of suicide in Minnesota, maybe amongst different older people, whatever, how that would be over time? And I guess my question is I think what I'm concerned about is that what we do works. And when we were funding, or when there was a funding stream to Minnesota, were we seeing differences in the rate? Or does the rate continue to grow through? I guess I'd be interested to see that comparison. So maybe for 10 years or something, and when we had funding, and before and after. But that would just be an interesting comparison to see.
We do. John Riesler, the state epidemiologist, did for our statewide conference put together the rates. Rates that the representative is speaking about are per 100,000. That's how the government measures it. So Minnesota, 10.8 per 100,000. And we do have that. We can show that to you. We can provide it to everybody on the committee. And what I can tell you is that during the time that this was being funded, there was a drop in our rate. We went down to about 9, and then we about 8.6. We're now on the rise again. We are 36th in the country right now in terms of our rate. But we can provide that to you.
Thank you. I appreciate if you could provide it to the whole committee. That would be great. And let me just ask you to also some information, if you could provide to us the $2.2 million, where that number actually came from, would be helpful for me to know. This is another one of the, I guess all three bills today are bills that were not recommended by the governor and that they're not in the budget. In order to know, you know, what we're going to have to work with, if you can just give us a little bit more information about how many people that serves and, you know, some of the rationale for the dollars. And I do want to thank all the witnesses who testified today, and this is a really important issue, and the committee will certainly look at it. So the motion is before us again from Representative Morgan that House File 315 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus committee bill. Any further discussion? And without objection, we'll slide over. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Thank you, Representative Otremba.